Welcome to another Vox Talk recorded at the CEPR Annual Symposium in Paris. My name is Tim Phillips. In this episode, three of the next generation of economists. At Vox Talks Economics, we always bring you new research from today's best economists. But whenever economists gather together, you will find many of tomorrow's best researchers too. They get a rare chance to present their work, and traditionally we like to ask three of them to talk to us about it as well. And it's always a pleasure to see the names of our past guests from these episodes popping up on the exciting and innovative research that we cover during the rest of the year. So for this symposium, we bring you three more of tomorrow's stars. One day you will say you heard them here first. We spoke to Matthias Molnar of Central European University, Laura Arneman of the University of Mannheim, and Gustavo Garcia Bernal of Sciences Po. Matthias, welcome.
Hi, Tim.
Laura.
Hi, Tim.
And Gustavo.
Hi, Tim.
Okay, Matthias, I'm coming to you first. We're going back to the year 1900 and the Paris International Exhibition. For those of us who weren't at the Paris International Exhibition, explain how important it was, who attended it, what was it?
There were more than 50 million visitors, more than 70,000 firms from more than 50 countries. And it was like a large event from April to November. And there were quite a few exhibitors, both in terms of technological innovations and also cultural artifacts and artistic objects as well.
At that time, it can't have been easy to attend an exhibition like this. Why would firms go to all the trouble and all the expense of attending?
It was an excellent opportunity to meet potential buyers, to present their new innovations and products, to get feedback for their products. It was not just an exhibition, it was a series of events like lectures, dinners, so people had plenty of opportunity to build connections, to form new networks. And there was also a competition. Some of the innovations or products were chosen by an independent jury. And if a firm managed to secure like a gold medal or an award, it was like a huge prestige for the firm.
I mean, that's all the good things. Were there bad things? Were there risks for attending an exhibition like this as well?
Yeah, so especially for innovations, firms were worried that their innovations or products might be copied by competitors. And even though the exhibition prohibited the, like, for example, drawing in these exhibition halls, firms were still worried, and sometimes they try to hide some parts of their machines or innovations so that they can still show that it's a great product, but competitors cannot copy it.
You can't draw anything because, of course, you couldn't walk around with a camera phone at that point.
Yeah, exactly.
So you have attempted to estimate the impacts of attending the exhibition. Now, for that, I would imagine you'd need some kind of natural experiment so you could get a causal relationship. But I would have thought that it's not a random sample of firms that attends the exhibition, is it? So what do you do about that?
Yes, that's a very important point. The problem is the selection bias. So firms that are already better or more innovative are usually selected for attendance. So we are controlling for it by looking at a different exhibition in Budapest 4 years before that, in 1896. And we compare the firms that attended this Paris exhibition, not to every firm in Hungary, but to a subsample of firms that attended that exhibition 4 years before. And that's already restricts the sample to firms that have innovations, that have the motivation to attend these kind of exhibitions. And that national exhibition in Budapest had awards also, like gold medal, silver medal, something like that. And we compare firms by these award categories. For each firm that attended this Paris exhibition in 1900, we find another firm that did not attend, but were similar in terms of other characteristics. So we are trying to match them to very similar firms and then see if the attendees actually grew faster.
And which outcomes are you trying to measure?
we try to measure the growth of firms in terms of size. Mm-hmm. We proxy size by the number of employees. And we also observe the machine capacity of the firms for mechanized firms. And this machine capacity is measured by the horsepower of the machine.
Right, yeah.
So it's just one number, but we see whether between 1896 and 1904, there was a growth in terms of this machine capacity. So this could be interpreted as technological adoption or capital investment. And besides that, we also measure the export propensity of the firms. And yeah, just to be clear, this is measured between 1896 and 1904 because it's historical data. So we don't observe these firms every year, only like every 4 or 5 years. If they appear in an export firm directory in 1904, then we assume that these firms were likely to export.
As you say, this is historical data. I mean, it certainly wasn't digitized at the time. Where did you find this data?
Most of the data I found in this National Archives of Hungary.
Wow.
It took some time to dig them up.
Yes.
For the exhibitions, we look at the exhibition catalogs. And for other outcomes, we use these firm registries. But some of these sources were not used by anyone else because when I found, for example, this 1904 data, I needed to ask the librarian to cut some of the pages because they were still sort of stuck together yeah. from the printing.
So having been the first person in 120 years to look up this data, what did you find from it? What was the effect of attending the Paris exhibition?
Our results indicate that firms that attended grew approximately 25% more in 8 years than firms that did not attend, both in terms of size and machine capacity. And we also find that for smaller firms, the ones that attended this Paris exhibition were more likely to appear in this exporting firm directory, which indicates that it was more likely that they became exporting firms after attending this Paris exhibition.
And what's the advantage of using this old data set from more than a century ago instead of a more recent alternative?
The advantage of using this historical setting is that it's easier to separate the Paris exhibition because we are really interested in how the government, the Hungarian government, helped these firms. And when governments give support for firms, for example, export promotion bundles, they usually help through various channels, for example, agencies, information services, diplomatic relation building or something like that. And in this case, we can separate the effect of the exhibition easier.
Matthias, I was just wondering, with increasing digitalization and knowledge becoming more accessible, do you think your findings would still hold in today's world?
Yes, there are exhibitions today as well. They are smaller in magnitude. However, I would expect to find similar results because these exhibitions help firms to meet other firms in a concentrated manner. And it's much easier to connect in a personal level than in online, like, for example, in Zoom calls or with emails. So I think this personal aspect is still quite relevant. And yeah, it's not a coincidence that there are still many exhibitions today.
Thank you very much. The historical research sounds very interesting, although quite arduous. Fast forward a century for you, Laura, and you've been examining the effect of tax changes on pay without performance for executives. Now, without performance, that sounds a bit hard to pin down. How do you define without performance?
So to give you like the technical definitions, yeah. I define pay without performance as the pass-through of profit shocks, which are outside of the executive's control, into their compensation. These are shocks that, for example, significantly affect firm profitability, but they are unrelated to any actions or decisions that the executive is taking. These could be, for example, changes in exchange rates or changes in the oil price that increase firms' profitability, yet they are beyond the influence of the executive. So in a sense, it means that the executive just got lucky by working, for example, for the right company at the right time. And research consistently shows that executive compensation tends to rise disproportionately in response to such lucky shocks, whereas there's limited effects on the compensation of the average worker.
And you're looking at the impact of a higher tax rate on this. Why would a higher tax rate moderate the growth of executive pay without performance? What's the mechanism here?
higher taxes can deter pay without performance by reducing kind of the executive's incentive to engage in bargaining over these uncontrollable profit shocks. So the idea behind this is that bargaining kind of requires effort. So executives need to persuade the board that they increase their pay. And when tax rates are low, then executives keep a larger share of any additional compensation that they negotiated for. So, for example, when you have no taxes, then every extra dollar that you secure in negotiations is a full dollar that you get in take-home pay. However, for example, if you have a 70% tax rate, then every additional dollar that you negotiate with the board only increases your take-home pay by 30 cents. And that makes effort into bargaining less worthwhile. And so the reduced incentive to bargain can moderate the growth in pay without performance.
And so let's have a look at empirically what you've done here. Which taxes are you considering?
I focus on executive pay in the US and I consider two types of taxes, federal personal income taxes and state personal income taxes. And my analysis takes advantage of changes in both rates. So I examine an increase in the federal tax rate in 2013, especially targeted at high income earners. For state tax rates, I explore variations across states. Some states like Florida and Texas, they have no extra personal income tax rate. However, others, such as, for example, California, they have income tax rates as high as 13% that people need to pay in addition to the federal income tax rate.
The US tax system. Amazing. Now, you also need changes in profitability, as you said, that have got nothing to do with anything that the executives have done. So what sort of changes did you choose for this?
I choose changes in the profitability, which are driven by shifts in global export demand. This captures changes in trade patterns that are unrelated to executive actions. Think about, for example, demand for cars in China rising due to people in China becoming wealthier. Then a company like Ford may benefit even without its executive doing anything specific. And this instrument isolates these external profit shocks and ensures that these changes in profitability that I observe are not driven by any changes in executive actions.
So the results for each set of tax changes, what are these results?
Surprisingly, I found that the results actually differ between federal and state tax rates. For federal tax rates, I find a small reduction in pay without performance, but this effect is weak and barely statistically significant. However, in contrast, state tax rates are associated with a significant increase in pay without performance. And the state level effect is also larger than the federal tax rate effect and highly statistically significant, which suggests that state taxes may have unintended consequences by increasing pay without performance.
This seems like a surprising result to me, both the differences that you find and the direction of the result. So how do you explain this?
Initially, I was also very puzzled by this discrepancy.
Yes.
And then I dug into the literature a bit on bargaining, and it actually provided a nice explanation. Outside options in bargaining play a critical role. When bargaining, an employer needs to at least match the outside option or the wage that another employer would pay the employee that they might receive from other firms. And so if state taxes now increase, but outside options might remain unaffected due to the fact that they are in a different state, the current employer may have to raise pay to remain competitive. However, if federal taxes increase, then usually all outside options are similarly affected, reducing the bargaining power of the executive. And to test this outside option channel, I also do a heterogeneity analysis among executives and differentiate between executives who can easily switch their employer and executives who cannot easily switch their employer. And I find that the positive effect of state taxes on pay without performance is indeed concentrated among executives who can easily switch their employer.
Now, we're in Paris, and this sort of topic, executive pay and how we might restrain executive pay if we think it's too high, that's something that's often discussed. And the policy prescription is, as you pointed out, often to raise taxes. Does this undermine that argument?
I wouldn't say that it necessarily undermines the argument. I only look at gross wages, but taxes do affect the net wage, and I can't make any statement about that. However, I think my findings highlight an additional channel where, for example, local taxes combined with labor mobility can actually exacerbate pay without performance. And if executives can leverage outside options from lower tax jurisdictions, then local tax increases may unintentionally increase pay without performance.
So do you find different effect in different industries?
Yeah, that's a super interesting question. So due to the way I measure these exogenous profit shocks, I'm a bit restricted to industries that also export. One thing I find is that industries where the market concentration is lower, there's a stronger effect. And I also argue that this is in line with what I call this outside option channel, because in industries that are not that concentrated, there are more outside options available to these executives.
I was thinking that it would be great if you could draw any conclusions for the European Union too. I know you are using US data and the context here is different, but to what extent can we extrapolate your results to the EU?
There are some differences between the EU and the US. For one, like, executive pay in the EU is generally much lower than in the US. Additionally, I think, at least from anecdotal evidence, executives in Europe are a lot less mobile than in the US. So, for example, in Germany, a lot of these executives stay in their companies for, I don't know, 20, 30 years. So this kind of lower mobility suggests that higher taxes might not increase pay without performance as much as in the US. However, if you think about the EU, countries are a lot smaller. For example, Luxembourg, if there would be a federal tax rate increase in Luxembourg, they might also mimic these like localized effects that I find for the state taxes.
Laura, thank you very much, especially for bringing us face to face with the terror of finding a result that wasn't what you expected. Gustavo, over to you. Now, you are investigating the extent to which intergenerational transmissions of wealth and income drive inequality. Again, something that we hear a lot about, especially in France. Transmissions of what?
There are direct and indirect transmissions. Donations and bequests are direct transfers of money from parents to children. But we also have indirect transmissions, which are less evident. They can be network or education, even genetics. They are important for explaining the positive correlation that we find between income of the parent and income of the child, for example.
Yeah, this is a very complicated question to investigate. I'm sure you know that much better than I do. Why is it important to discover how inequality is transmitted through generations?
First, in most advanced economies, the inequalities in income and wealth have been increasing over the last decades. We have plenty of evidence for that. And we also have evidence that many of those inequalities, both in income and wealth, originate at early life stages. They depend on our initial education or wealth. These initial conditions depend on our family background. This leads to what we call the intergenerational transmission of inequalities. So there are two reasons. First, we want to know to what extent this upward trend in inequality comes from these intergenerational mechanisms and to what extent they reinforce each other. And there is also a motive of inequality of opportunity, because parental transmissions are beneficial to those receiving them, and we want to find the best ways to support those who don't receive it.
Now, it'd be really convenient if these transfers just happened once at a set time. This isn't so, is it? So this complex process that you have, how can you represent that in your model?
In the model, I pay special attention to direct transmissions. So people receive donations and bequests at different moments in life, and they anticipate it. So this affects their behavior. Regarding indirect transmissions, they are more difficult to model, but they are also present in my framework. Otherwise, it wouldn't be possible to capture this dynastic persistence that we see empirically in income.
Yeah, and your data needs to be quite detailed as well, because it needs to identify the wealth and income and when these transfers are happening. What do you do about that? How do you find it?
Exactly. I need all that. I use the Household Finance and Consumption Survey from the European Central Bank, which includes information on income, wealth, donations, and bequests received at the individual level.
Right. So there's a lot you could probably discover, but package it up for me. What do you discover about the effect of the transmission of wealth and income on mobility, intergenerational mobility?
For the moment, the model is not well suited to talk about mobility, but I am indeed working in this direction. I can say some things about the effects of these transmissions.
Yes.
They have different effects depending on your age. We see that donations have a large impact when we are young, and because we make investments for the future, such as education or starting a business. Bequests tend to happen much later in life, around age 55. So they don't have that much of an impact, although they do lead to a more concentrated distribution of wealth. About mobility, for the same reason, bequests happen later, so they don't really matter for mobility. Donations is still work in progress, but we do expect them to matter much more because of these education and investments mechanisms.
Now, the reason why we're all so interested in this and why we discuss it so much is because if we decided that we could have organized society in a better way, and it's not clear exactly what that would be, it's also not exactly clear what policies would have the effect to get us where we wanted to go. So are you considering policy options? What ones are you considering and what impacts do you think they might have?
Exactly. The idea here is to provide a framework so that we can think of this type of issues and test different policy interventions that could improve welfare at use or reduce inequality of opportunity. Here, I'm studying an universal inheritance. This is a proposal that some well-known economists, such as Piketty or Atkinson, have brought up to fight inequality of opportunity. And the idea is to give a lump sum transfer to everyone at use. Here, what I do is I consider small-scale universal inheritance that everyone receives at age 25 and that it would be financed with a raise in progressive taxation. And what is cool about this kind of macroeconomic models is that we can identify winners and losers. So we see overall, when we introduce the policy, wealth inequality among youth is reduced at the cost of some decrease in parental transfers, both in bequests and in donations. But we can go further and identify who is winning and who is losing. We see that children from poorer families are benefiting from redistribution, but other children from not so poor families, they also benefit because access to credit at use is limited, and this policy could help to overcome this problem. However, not everything is good. We also find people who lose. And in this case, it's children from wealthier families, because even though they also receive the public transfers, they didn't really need it because they were already receiving parental transfers in the form of donations. And they expect to receive large inheritances in the future that now could be more heavily taxed. So that's why they lose.
So Gustavo, one thing I was wondering is, one motivation for parents to accumulate wealth, for example, through entrepreneurship, is to pass this on to their children. How does your policy experiment affect these motives?
Indeed, we see that leaving a bequest is an important motive for wealth accumulation after retirement. After the inheritance tax is raised, parents know that the state will take a larger share of the bequest, and therefore they do reduce the bequest left by reducing their accumulation of wealth.
So based on your model, would you raise inheritance tax?
It depends on how the tax receipts are used. I haven't computed the optimal policy. I just ran a particular experiment as an example where I studied this combination of an inheritance tax with a universal inheritance. The inheritance tax by itself implies welfare losses in my model. First for parents, because they like to leave a bequest, and also for inheritors, because they receive lower net inheritances. So if it was only about raising the inheritance tax, the answer would be no, we shouldn't do it because people are hurt from it. Welfare is reduced. However, if we use it for a transfer, it might be overall welfare improving. In my simulation, we see that when we use this tax revenue to finance a universal inheritance, there are winners and losers, and whether the policy should be implemented depends on how we aggregate these welfare gains and losses. With my model, when we give the same weight to everyone, we do see that the policy is overall welfare improving.
Before I let you go, there was another question I wanted to ask you. You are hopefully going to be in the economics profession for quite some time. In recent years, a lot of economists have been wondering what the economics profession could do better. So at this point, I want to ask you that question. What do you think economics could do better, Laura?
So I think the economics profession could still do a better job at being more inclusive. I think Matthias and I, we talked about this before the podcast recording. If you look around a lot of conferences, then a lot of people you see are older white men. And I think...
You looked at me when you said
that. I explicitly did not look at you. No, but I think that it's important to have like different people with different backgrounds and different perspectives at the table. And in particular, if you study such an important topic as economics. And I think one way that the economics profession could change it, or is also trying to change this, is to provide like more networking opportunities opportunities for people who are a minority in the economics profession. But I think it could also do a better job, or senior professors also could do a better job at also approaching people who are in a minority at a conference and being nice to them and talking to them and asking them about their research. I think that would also make a huge impact.
Good point. Yeah, Gustavo.
In my case, when I listen to economists in seminars and especially interviews, sometimes I have the impression that our discussions abstract too much from people's actual concerns. So I think we should discuss our ideas with people around us more often, not only with people inside academia, but also outside it.
For me, I would really like to see the improvement of the publication process. So, for example, if someone submits a paper to a journal, it shouldn't be ignored for 6 months or a year. Also, I think it would be nice to include more research with zero results, especially if the topic is interesting and the research design is good, but maybe the results are not there. I think that that would also add value to the accumulation of knowledge, because I think there's a bias that you need to have, like not always, but very often you need to have strong results to be published, but it's not necessarily that informative.
Well, I hope you get your wishes. In a few years' time, you're going to be in charge of these processes, so that'll be down to you at that point. But until then, thank you very much for spending time with me today. Thank you, Laura.
Thanks, Tim.
Thank you, Gustavo.
Thank you, Tim.
And thank you, Matthias.
Thank you very much.
Look out for those papers. They are International Exhibitions as Trade Promotion, an analysis of firm development from the 1900 Paris World Fair, Matthias Molnar. Taxes and Pay Without Performance, Evidence from Executives, Laura Arneman. And From Parent to Child, International Wealth Dynamics and Inequalities, Gustavo Garcia Bernal.
Next time on Vox Talks Economics, is there a menopause penalty in the workplace?